Start the meeting, when we have a quorum, we'll officially start the meeting, but today we're going to start the Health and Human, or excuse me, the Human Services budget, and we have Commissioner Ludeman to give us a few opening remarks. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Chairman Huntley, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce the Governor's budget recommendations for Human Services today. I would like to just make some preliminary comments. I think after I am done with these comments, Jane Rankin, our budget director, will give some another brief overview about how the numbers in the budget pages are arranged for the committee to be able to examine them at every level of detail that the committee desires. And then we will start immediately to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, for example, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care, to start to go through the Governor's recommendation. Throughout this state, there is a growing recognition that almost daily reminders of the problems caused by the national recession. While many citizens may still desire to put things back the way they were or keep things the way they are, neither is possible. A $4.8 or approximately $5 billion deficit in Minnesota state government necessitates a very significant change in the current relationship the state has with citizens, providers, the human service infrastructure, and with other local governments and agencies. We recognize that as the economy falters, demand for human services rises. That makes it especially important to target services so that we are able to help continue helping those most in need. The Governor's budget proposal is rightfully the topic for this examination and discussion today and for some days to come. However, 2009 is unique for two reasons. The pending federal stimulus package may dramatically alter possibilities in both the current fiscal year and the years 2010 and 11. I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, that there will be every reason for you and this committee to review those possibilities after the stimulus becomes a reality. Also, that the February economic forecast, which will be released in the first month of March, could certainly further deteriorate the state's financial position, also changing the possibilities in balancing a state budget. The Governor's proposed budget for human services reduces spending. While it preserves core services for the most vulnerable people, it also advances reforms that will make the human service system stronger in the long run. The proposal makes explicit how much money is spent by DHS to provide or purchase health and human services for nearly 1 million Minnesotans. The Governor proposes human service spending in FY 10 and 11 of approximately $11.7 billion in direct appropriated funds from the General Fund, Health Care Access Fund, and temporary assistance to needy families. This represents a 9.6% increase in spending for the current biennium. Without reductions of approximately $1.4 billion, our budget was on a path to grow by 21.5%. That level of growth is unsustainable. DHS represents 28% of the state's general fund budget, and health care programs, which include medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and GAMC, General Assistance Medical Care, are the fastest growing state budget costs of 26.3%. Reductions to human service programs must be a significant part of the effort to reduce spending. The Governor's budget preserves the basic safety net for children, the elderly, and Minnesotans with disabilities who are unable to provide for themselves. For example, we preserve publicly funded health care coverage for the elderly, people with disabilities, children, and many families. We continued key investments in children. We fully fund adoption assistance, which helps the families adopt special needs children under state guardianship. We preserve core benefits for those on publicly funded programs, but trim some benefits in order to preserve coverage for the most enrollees. We will continue to deliver services with respect, dignity, and as much independence as possible. Because most spending on human services is for health care and related programs, those areas will see significant reductions. Approximately 670,000 Minnesotans were enrolled in a state-funded health care program in fiscal year 2008. As a result of these proposals, approximately 84,000 adults who are currently enrolled will lose eligibility. This includes 55,000 adults without children who lose Minnesota care coverage effective January in 2010. and 29,000 parents who lose Minnesota Care coverage effective July 2010. Under current law, enrollment in Minnesota health care programs is expected to increase by approximately 100,000 people in the next 2 years. With the governor's proposed changes, total enrollment will again be approximately 697,000 by the end of 2011. But this budget is not just about reductions. These proposals also include a number of significant reforms. For example, we propose North Star Care for Children, which will simplify and equalize payments to families who provide foster care or relative care or adopt children from the state's child welfare system. It combines three programs into one simplified program that stabilizes payments to families. Better targeting the state's limited resources for personal care attendance services is imperative for this fast-growing yet needed program. Reforms over the next 3 years that streamline and normalize the rates paid for chemical dependency treatment and lead to more cost-effective statewide services. Healthcare program simplification, which would simplify eligibility standards and administration of Minnesota healthcare programs. And a new vision for administration of human service programs themselves, using joint county entities rather than the current 84 county units. The governor's budget proposal represents significant changes for human services. Already this budget has generated conversations and ideas amongst policyholders, legislators, stakeholders about how we can change the way we do business to meet the needs of vulnerable Minnesotans. I look forward to a thoughtful discussion that I hope will continue to unfold over the course of the session. Thank you, Chairman Hundley.
Any questions for Commissioner Ludeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, we all know that we're going to make some very serious cuts in practically every program the state's involved in. But we have to make sure that we don't destroy institutions we're going to need 5 years from now. And certainly there's some of your proposed cuts are going to take some small hospitals, put them in serious difficulty. They're already in serious difficulty. And we've totaled up the numbers. It looks like about 113,000 people will lose health insurance from our program. At the same time, we have probably 10% of our people are going to be unemployed and not have health insurance by the middle of the summer. So how are we going to keep these hospitals surviving?
Mr. Chairman, the marketplace of the health care costs in the system are not only related to public-funded programs, as you know. A lot of the new uncompensated costs that the hospitals are suffering are from what you would call the middle class, who have been advised in their credit counseling that health care costs are one of the last ones that some people should pay. That's bad advice. That makes it very unbusinesslike, and it makes it very difficult for Minnesota hospitals in this environment. The 3%, for example, rateable reduction in the governor's proposal is 3%. It compares to 15 or 20% reductions that some of the commercial health plans are advising would be the rate reduction in the commercial rates. The other thing I would have to say, Mr. Chairman, is the stimulus package, and I don't think we want to have all that conversation today, talks about a substantial FMAP or use of Medicaid dollars to subsidize COBRA payments, for example, for recently unemployed or future unemployed citizens in the state. We'll have that conversation when the stimulus package becomes a reality. But moving to a 9 or 10% unemployment rate would be a major concern as well that could result in uncovered individuals. But I think the stimulus package is going to have a substantial contribution to some of the solutions for that problem. The Minnesota Care, as you know, is not as much about hospitals as it is about preventive care, which is primary care clinics. It does have a hospital benefit, but it has a fairly significant cap to that benefit. The answer to what hospitals will have to do in a business environment to survive to change, to transform as best they can in this environment is a condition that even state agencies have to suffer as well. So that is where we're at with this budget and this economy.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, hi, there you are.
I see you.
And I recognize this for what it is. It's an opening, kind of a, not even, it's really an offer because you don't know what all the NASA money might be. And I'm taking it as a collection of ideas that people will be looking at. And I hope that as we ask questions of the witnesses that I'll be focusing on, you know, why would this be meritorious? To that question, in some of the changes that were made in some of the programs, dental, for instance, I'm interested not from you, but just if you could help, I don't think it's in the detail on our sheets, but like when you cut dental out of crisis, critical care access and so on, those people are going to wind up in the ER with other infections, and I know that you knew that, but there must be an add back for some costs. Are we able to get the tracking sheets for those optional things that were deleted and the different things where there was an add back for some of the secondary costs that the finance people must have determined?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, that's a good question. I think I'm not sure Lauren Coleman, the next one to testify, is quite the appropriate one, but Dr. Reed Sulik, who is the AC for Chemical and Mental Health and State-Operated Services, would probably be best to be able to provide numbers and dollars that would, I think you're talking about mitigation services that would be able to be filled. He'd be able to, the best one to provide that answer.
And Mr. Chair, I don't think I want that at the table. I think it just would be there's a worksheet that they did, I'm sure, for each of those, and that would be productive to look at that as we consider which of these makes some sense. I have just one more question on that. You're the globalist, I think, as we...
Never been called that, Mr. Ryan.
Oh, yeah, good point. Anyway, you're the big picture commissioner person. What do you... do you have an idea from your discussions with the various people in Washington what you think is going to be available to us in the big picture, $1 billion that we can mitigate some of this stuff with that's going to be with no strings, or is it going to be $2 billion with strings? Do you have a sense of that? And you're not bound, it's just a sense question.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the dollars in the House bill and the Senate bill, which looks to even be larger, but not actually in the healthcare arena, it's bigger for other reasons, could be a very significant contribution to Minnesota in this area. The FMAP bump alone is the 4.9 bump is a substantial amount of money, but if you add the tiered version of where we are with our unemployment in Minnesota, it could, for example, constitute over $500 million contribution for the fiscal year 09, the one that we're in, over $900 million in the next fiscal year, and $400 and some million in the subsequent year. So it's, you're talking about $1.8 or $9 billion in this year. This does not include HIT dollars. The dislocated worker portion of that bill, and there's a substantial food support, USDA. Some people call it food stamps. We call it food support provision in that as well.
Just one more question, and I'm done.
Representative Abler.
And can you, is it, I have not, I don't have a lot of Washington connections. I live in Anoka, but that's why I'm asking these questions. Is that the supplement and not supplant, or is that going to allow us for some backfilling some of our programs that are based upon our state deficit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I think, you know, and I think we need to have a lot of discussion about this upon the passage of the stimulus package, but the basic philosophy is not too different from what happened in 2003. Basically, and you would understand Congress's desire to establish a maintenance of effort at some point before the passage of the bill. They're talking about July 1st of 2008, for example. So Medicaid-funded enrollments would have to be reestablished for the point in time of July 1, for example. And that is where that coverage or that eligibility would have to be restored and be eligible for that Medicaid dollar.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Greetings, Commissioner. There's a lot here, obviously. You guys have sharp pencils at the Department of Human Services. I'm wondering if you can share with me, or if later in the testimony today we could talk a little bit more about your ideas about the simplification of the administration of the public programs, please.
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner.
Representative Murphy, I don't think that was today, but I think it's tomorrow or the next day. Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg will give you every detail that you need about simplification. We call it both alignment and simplification. There are four reasons, basically, for health care costs in state programs to go up. One of those reasons is complexity. And so our administrative complexity is more profound than even, for example, an insurance company, which would, for example, receive a tape or a computer tape to say these are the enrollees. We have program integrity obligations to make sure these people truly are eligible based on income, citizen status, previous employer-sponsored insurance that no other insurance company has to provide coverage. This is what I'm talking about in getting those simplification ideas put together so that we don't have such complexity that we can't even pull off a system development to make eligibility more automatic for Minnesota citizens. That'll be a major topic of discussion.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned that complexity is one of the four cost drivers. What are the other three from your perspective?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, basically it's complexity, enrollment, the number of people that you cover, the benefits of which you provide to those that you enroll, and then what is called medical trend, or I don't know if we use the word inflation anymore in these times or not. It's almost a deflationary environment, but normally would be called medical trend, cost-driven elements.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And Commissioner, we did a lot of work, or we began, I think, important work on the issue of medical trends and costs last session together.
Yes, we did.
So can you share with us how you think the work that we're going to do this session around the budget is going to impact the work that we've already begun on trying to tip the trend line down, please?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's a very good question. I think you're referring to most of what we call the health reform package that was passed last year and some previous to that. Excuse me. Commissioner Magnin may be the more appropriate one to answer it, but it is my understanding that we are not jeopardizing any of that work. So the all the RFPs that have already been let out to do work in many of those areas is continuing. It's not jeopardized by the governor's proposal. There is one exception to that that Commissioner Magnin would describe to you better, and that is in the what is called the State Health Improvement Program. There's a significant reduction in that program, but she would be able to tell you why they believe that it can still be administered for maximum effect. So I believe that to get to the value proposition of what it is that we purchase and how we purchase it is still in the marketplace and through that work of the health reform packages that was passed last year and not jeopardized by these budget discussions.
Mr. Chair, just two more quick questions.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in the years past when we've talked about health care reform, people have used the metaphor of a balloon and squeezing a balloon, and if you squeeze it here, it bulges out in another place. So I'm concerned about the cuts in enrollment, as I'm sure you are, and how that impacts the medical trend line, right? Because we're just really going to be shifting the cost of those folks to other parts of the healthcare delivery system, not really cutting costs, but just moving them. Is that a fair assessment from your perspective?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I hope it is not the right assessment. I think the fact that those most dependent on public-funded programs or even those enrolled in public programs are probably going to be the ones on the bubble or the in the balloon to transform themselves as faster than other people in the system. But it also means, for example, hospitals will have to do more. A ratable reduction and quarterly payments looks like a very blunt instrument, and we understand that. But at the same time, it could be the reason for those systems to be able to start to transform themselves. We would like to enable that as much as we possibly can in payment systems that put the dollars more successfully upstream in the system where it needs to be, for the most part in primary care and preventive care. But it is a tough time to have this conversation when these blunt instruments are to be applied. But I think there's opportunity here for transformation if our enlightened providers are able to think that way after they get used to the idea that maybe fewer dollars are in the system.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner. I think the work that we began last year is so important, and I so don't want us to slip backwards, and I'm concerned about that, and I'm sure others are as well. Just one more question, and that has, it's a very specific question now in terms of the budget. You know, we talked a lot about care coordination last year and really focusing on better care for the people that are the most sick, chronically ill. And in the budget, we do eliminate funding for a lot of the therapies, so physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, et cetera, for adults, adults with disabilities, et cetera. Can you shed some light on that? Is that another one of those blunt instruments that you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's the only way I could describe it. You're talking about rehabilitative services, which is very important, but it has been incorporated into what we call a coverage in the way we administer it, and this will cause a lot of discussion about that. To the degree that it does not, this budget does not jeopardize our other system for chronic, there's a difference between chronic disease and what these therapies are being used for are a little different than a chronic disease. These are more are true rehabilitative services. The other primary care coordination program is protected in this budget, and the care coordination fees that come out of that health reform budget ideas of last year would still be able to be delivered on schedule. But the rehabilitative services will be a very major point of discussion, I'm sure, during the session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And I'm wondering how the administration of the department is complying with some of the governor's recommendations. Is your administration part of your budget being cut, and how is that relative to other departments of the state?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we're fully participating in administrative reductions. We have to do it actually at a higher level to accomplish a net of 5%, so we have to cut more because there are some federal dollars involved in that. So it is significant. I should tell you, and the members of this committee deserve to know, that we have already reduced our FTE count over 400 FTEs since March of this year. So to the degree that we have a... that is not our deliberate purpose. We're using it using attrition as successfully as we possibly can and have been for quite some time. If you call that a running start to getting to administrative reductions, I would accept that. But there would be, based on enrollment and the success of simplification, there would be some opportunities for administrative reductions there as well. This will be a constant a management effort on the part of this department, to not just in the next few months, but for the next several years, to make sure our administrative costs are as efficient as they possibly can be.
And members, we have a quorum. We can call the meeting order. The commissioner's been off the record officially until this moment. So whatever he said, we have to put in order as much as we usually do, I guess, Mr. Commissioner. And so, and that's been Kiff Meyer would like to be in the minutes as moving the minutes for their approval. Any discussion about that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's approved. Representative Bunn, you get the first official word of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm honored to be Commissioner. Since the issue of administrative efficiencies and FTEs were just brought up, just a follow-up question related to that. We've obviously seen a lot in the news lately related to possible inefficiencies, fraud, abuse, those kinds of things, whether or not our agencies have sufficient internal auditing capabilities, oversight of programs, those kinds of things. What words of reassurance can you provide us that significant cuts in FTEs like this are not going to infringe or, in fact, further reduce your internal oversight capabilities of these programs that taxpayers very much want to be assured are being administered in appropriate ways?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, actually, you put a different slant on it than usually is talked about in that realm. First of all, there was a fairly significant, let's say it was significant, Medicaid fraud incident in our department. This you probably read about it. I think in a day or two you will be delivered a four-page document from the Office of the Legislative Auditor that will outline in detail sort of the facts of the case. And I think there's still one legal proceeding left, sentencing, for the employee in that regard. So I'm not sure exactly how much I can talk about that, but the controls have already been put in place. Even before that incident, there were new controls put in place that were internal auditing controls and assurance that by function and process, this would be much less likely to happen. But to have a deeply entrenched employee at a supervisory level being able to do criminal things is always hard work and hard to rot out, but we don't tolerate it. It will not be done again as best that we can prevent it. So those controls are in. It doesn't take a lot of FTE work once the system and the controls are put into place as a procedure for double signatures. And you'd have to read the OLA a letter for, I think, the best explanation about some of these new controls. So I don't feel jeopardized that we would be less vigilant with fewer controls. We've already got more controls than ever before on what would be called a fraud.
And members, this topic's going to be brought up more on the 11th for whatever they can talk about it. Representative Bond, do you have a more follow-up?
Well, just a quick follow-up. I was referring more less to that episode than to the more recent news article of the last few days. I think your county was mentioned in it, Mr. Chair. In terms of, sufficient oversight over eligibility that, you know, some counties do more or less of this and those kinds of things. So it's more broad-based, not criminal, you know.
I understand.
Internal criminal.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative, you will see in this proposal actually a line item which actually has initiative and new costs associated with it that will have a lot to do with fraud investigation and powers within this department. With controversy, I'll warn you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a very specific question about how the budget's put together. And we have a statute in place in 256B that says you're supposed to include inflationary adjustments in payment rates to a whole bunch of providers in your budget that you present to us. And I don't think that's ever been done since I've been here. And I'm just wondering why you guys haven't been following that provision. It's 256B.038.
I kind of like that law. Commissioner.
Chairman, Representative, I'm going to have I'm not sure.
And I'm kind of asking it so whoever is going to address that can have an answer for us.
Right, yeah. After me for the next 5 minutes. I'm not, she is new to the department. That doesn't excuse anything. We'll get the right answer to you to answer that question.
And I guess one other question, Mr. Chair, just, and this is more general for you, and that is when you kind of put together this budget, do you do any internal analysis of kind of the spin-out human effects of some of these cuts that will have on other parts of the budget or on people's lives, and is it possible for us to kind of see those analyses, because it's much harder for us to do that sitting around this table than you who've had several months to kind of pull this together?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we do this constantly, forever, for 60 or 70 days, and I'm not sure exactly what you mean. I mean, some of them are just intuitively evident about the what I think you're calling the human consequences of some of these reductions.
Well, I'm thinking, like, are we going to see, if we reduce health care, Mr. Chair, for instance, what are we going to see in terms of increases in emergency room care? What are we going to see in terms of increases in, some of our welfare systems? For instance, what are we going to see in terms of increases in domestic violence? What are we going to see in terms of increases in a whole variety of these things that are going to cost us money? And I just wondered, is there, like, internal, have you guys done documents that do that analysis or some kind of analysis that looks at that? Because these are really, really drastic, as you, I think everybody around the table understands, reductions in care. And the other question, I guess, on that, have you done any analysis of cutting parents off health care on the effect of whether their children get enrolled in health care? Because I think that there actually is a connection there.
Mr. Chairman, we have lots of conversations, and there's actually a lot of internal debate about some of these other consequences. The last one is easier. It's actually in our forecast documents. We do know that, for example, if parents lose eligibility in Minnesota care, many children will come off of Minnesota care even though they're fully eligible. And that's a calculable a number that's actually in our documents in the forecast. This would be thousands. children that would lose eligibility, not because of a state law change, but because parents, if they're coming off, take their children off or elsewhere. And where they go is hard to calculate, whether there's private alternatives available to them, which I think in some instances there would be, but it would be hard for us to be able to calculate. So we're just measuring what we know by history and about enrollment, about what that calculation is. And it's significant in children as well.
And Mr. Chairman, up to the kind of other broader analysis?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Heath, and I don't know if there's lots of internal documents that would be searched for to make these calculations. I know as it affects corrections, some of the other issues that I think you're referring to, we do not have a successful way to calculate what it affects other state budgets, for example, other agencies, if there's going to be more problems in other areas. It's certainly talked about and considered about what those effects are. I'm not offering up any documents, I guess, about it because I don't know that they truly exist.
And Mr. Chair, so did you just say that because the corrections is a different budget, is there a forecast effect shown in the corrections budget?
No, there is not, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman. It is a real, even more basic question. What are you statutorily obligated to do as an agency for us to produce a budget? Is the governor, in fact, statutorily defined to produce a budget or your agency at a given time? Or how is that work?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Deaton, yes, the governor is statutorily required to offer a budget. It doesn't, technically doesn't have to actually be in bill form, but he offers the budget which you see before you today, and that's what it is.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, is there anything that would prohibit our committee or the legislature, the House, from moving on a budget at the same time or before you offering that budget? Is that defined anywhere in statute, as far as you know?
Commissioner?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know there's no statute to prohibit the legislature from acting on the budget of the governor's, amending the governor's budget or adopting a budget of their own at any time. The governor, there are 3,000 pages of documentation on the MMB's website that are supplemental documentation on the governor's budget. What you see before you are probably budget pages that describe each and every change that we are recommending in the governor's proposal as it relates to DHS. So we are very transparent in exactly what it is that we're trying to accomplish, why, and the best we can calculate what the consequences of each of those reductions, at least, would be. It is also, though, Mr. Representative Dean, not a zero-based budget. We're not fooling ourselves to believe that this is a truly zero-based budget, but it is now so transparent and involves virtually every part of DHS. It's as close as you're going to see in quite a few years about how DHS spends its money and how much it does spend would be in front of you because of the government's budget.
And
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lumen, I appreciate how hard your folks have been working on this and putting this together, and I do know that you do understand the impact from one program to another. For example, if you take people off of Minnesota Care, that's going to increase uncompensated care, and I know that you folks factor that into these budget numbers and others, and it's a very difficult task to do. It's very easy to critique and very difficult to complete, so I look forward to our committee's work in moving forward on this as well.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, if I can take a look, and I think it's a little bit of answering a little bit of what you're talking about, Representative Thiessen, if I may. But if an insurance company was to do this for a pooled group of people or even an individual, we would call it underwriting. If the state government programs do it, we call it forecasting. So that we have actuaries and actuarial ability to make the best calculation we can about the effects of this as it relates to enrollment, as it relates to changes in behavior, is part of the science of what we in state government call forecasting, and those documents reflect those changes. The children's coverage would be a good example of that.
Commissioner, we have two more people with questions, then we're going to move on to that content, I think. So Representative Kiffmeyer has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Ludeman.
My question there, though, is because I heard one word used, cuts or reductions, and then I heard your introduction about the fact that, just so I can be sure, in the proposed 2010-11 budget, there is to be an increase in spending for what was done in 08-09. And what? And just to affirm again, so there's going to be an increase in spending, and what percent is that increase in spending again, in both percent and dollars?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kipmeyer, we currently spend in this current budget $10.7 billion. In this governor's proposal, we would spend $11.7 billion, which represents 9.6% increase.
Okay.
That is not to avoid the issue that there are dramatic, over-the-cliff reductions for certain individuals who will lose their coverage. Is a 100% reduction for them. But for the sake of the state budget and what we're trying to accomplish, it is a significant actual increase in spending as well. The one thing I did say in those opening comments is if we did nothing, if the statute did change, we would be covering well over 800,000 Minnesotans by the end of the fiscal 10-11 year.
Which just some piece into that.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, the 9.7% is a biennial increase?
Yes, it is.
And so that's, what, about 4% a year, 4.2% a year?
Less than half of that, yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, and what's been the historic average for health care increases in the private sector over the last couple of years? Above that, right? On an annual basis.
Chairman, Representative, that would be yes. It's by the year 2000, we were suffering 15 or 16% increases. It has trended to single digits, but not at 4.5%.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate the commissioner, recognizing that kind of just language games over whether these are cuts or not. The impact on people is that these are cuts, and to be honest, they're going to be unavoidable for any of us to deal with. I think it's the scope of it, but I don't think we should play games around the fact that we are going to be actually cutting health care for people. Thank you.
Substantive, and part of the advantage the department has, they don't give provider increases, so that helps keep their rates a little bit lower. Representative Bond gets the last question for the commissioner.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Ludeman. A lot of talk has occurred about zero-based and priority-based budgeting, and both sides of the aisle were all interested in that. I know much of this budget in particular in Health and Human Services is driven by federal requirements and various kinds of mandates that we don't have a choice necessarily to zero them out in any way. But for the portions of your budget that are not mandated by the federal government, to the extent that there are portions, how did your department in constructing this budget think about, from the ground up, which of those programs merited continuing funding versus those that might not, or how did you raise those issues in your budget discussion?
Commissioner. Chairman, Representative Bunn, actually you will see in our budget there's categories of what is called investments or initiatives that are actually required because to maintain federal requirement or compliance. So you will see how we have had to think about what it is that we have to do, whether we want to or not, to become in compliance with achieving a matching dollar FMAP, which is federal medical assistance percentage. We are one of the states of the 11 or 12 that are at the lowest end of that FMAP reimbursement at 50% for the most part for coverage. So you will see, you'll be instructed, I think, by that part of it is federal compliance. Obviously, what we're dealing with in 2009 with the stimulus package is considerably different when it relates to an MOE. But you should know that whatever the governor has put aside in the stimulus package, which he said is conservative, and I believe that is a conservative representation, the $920 million that was put aside on that, I don't want there to be confusion about that against an agency budget, this is a liability, not an asset. So to balance the entire state budget, we would have to make up the $920 million in some way first. Not all in human services, but it would have to be established that first. But what is different about Medicaid that a lot of people still need to know that in any state that adults without children are dealt with completely differently than parents with children or people with disabilities or elderly dual eligible individual. So what is different about that is we maintained some coverage for adults without children, but that biggest number of those losing current eligibility in Minnesota care are also adults without children. So I think that's at least a partial answer to your question. And these things are all part of the discussion as we make determinations of what it is to do. None of that describes some of the benefit reductions, Commissioner Coleman will be talking to you about PCA reform, level of care, determinations, assessments. A lot of these are more administrative ways that we would do it, need to do under federal constraints, but simply things we have to do because they are such fast-growing portions of our budget.
Commissioner Longy, you talk, and more people want to talk to you, so Justin Gottlaw has a question. So,
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll take up my answers, Mr. Chair.
Just to comment, as much as I appreciate the line of questioning about what these cuts really mean to people, and I think we're all very interested in that and wanting to know more about that, I think it also highlights we were on a trend to go to almost 19-20% growth in health and human services, almost unsustainable, to the point where eventually we may have had to disenroll people. We were already underpaying providers, which causes its own cost shifting. I think this also highlights the need, in addition to looking at who we're covering on public programs, the need to expand private coverage options, to eliminate mandates, to really reduce costs of healthcare coverage so we can expand access both publicly and privately. And I think this highlights that once again, when we depend only on government to provide that coverage, we run into these situations with revenue and so forth. And so I think it's not either or, it's both and. And so hopefully part of our discussion at this committee and others will be, how do we increase private options? How do we eliminate mandates? How do we increase efficiencies? How do we get people more engaged in their health care? And how do we deal with paying providers what it actually costs so that we're not cost shifting to others and making it harder for them to afford health care coverage?
Representative Broad.
I have a question, not a statement, but
whatever you like.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I'm looking at your tracking proposal sheet, and I don't know if this is what you brought or somebody else brought it, but I'm looking at the summary of enrollment changes and things along those lines, and I'm trying to connect it to some of the forecasts that have been done in the past and versus actual either enrollment or unenrollment. It seems as though in our forecast we're missing the mark either on the number of folks who are unenrolled or the number of folks who we expect to come into the system. So I'm wondering, when you do your forecasting or when you have the forecasting done, do you look at where things didn't quite match up last time? How do you actually change it so that we get more accurate along the way? I think, you know, I recall some of the proposals last time when we had to make some cuts that we were, it was suggested that X number of people were going to lose their health care, but only a portion of that did, and vice versa in terms of those who gained when we did have some extra dollars. So can you help me understand that a little bit better in a small period of time?
Commissioner, I don't know how to answer the last part. I'll do the best I can in as short a time as I can. Mr. Chairman and Representative Broad.
Take your time.
That's a very good question. First of all, by the nature of some of the enrollment procedures that we have, particularly in GMC, it takes almost 5 months to close out what we consider 5 months ago the actual number of people enrolled in a public program. So when we get to these total forecasted numbers, it's already 5 months old. That takes us almost to the end of the last fiscal year. So when I said 670,000 people currently enrolled in public programs, that is the best, last, most accurate number that I can use as a snapshot of average monthly enrollment. So, but as you know, in many programs, not MA, but in Minnesota Care, and particularly in GMC, the churn, which is the turnover, is very substantial. It isn't the same number of 28,000 people in GMC that stay enrolled for the entire year. That churn is 2.5 times over a given fiscal year. So this is the best way we can snapshot average monthly enrollment in public programs. And so when I said 670,000, that is actually the last most current accurate snapshot of that enrollment. The forecast, though, is supposed to say, based on no statutory change, what would the enrollment be by the end of 2011, and that's a substantial higher number, obviously, than 670,000. With the governor's changes, that number actually is still higher than 670,000. And so I think those are the best, most accurate forecast numbers. But learning the perspective of what they really are not real. Representative Thiessen is trying to talk about real people, and so am I. So forecast numbers is an important question about the effects of legislation. But it is a forecasted estimate of what people not only that would currently enrolled. So when I said 84,000 people, that is about as real a number as I can talk about. It's people currently enrolled today who, if this proposal would change, would lose eligibility. But there is also another group of people who potentially could be enrolled or would be enrolled according to a forecast that because eligibility changes would not be enrolled by any possibility in that time.
Just to follow up, I mean, I agree in terms of we've really got to start digging down into what are the impacts on individuals, and you know, tossing language around or tossing numbers around is what I'm trying to get at is how do we create the best numbers possible so that we don't have flamboyant accusations on either side related to who's getting tossed off here or off there. And then the other question I had, Commissioner, was will you be able to provide us information related to how many people who may be being pulled out of one program might be served by another? Is that something that I don't need it today? I'm just wondering along the way, is that something that your department will be able to provide us with a good numerical value?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rob, there is, and you'll hear every bit about that you wanted in level of detail. I will give you one big example, if I can. The parents currently enrolled in Minnesota Care were to be given an option of either going into medical assistance or Minnesota Care if they are 100% of poverty or less. Those parents would be enrolled in MA under this governor's proposal, but there would obviously then not exist a choice. They would be enrolled in Minnesota Care. So parents of 100% of poverty or less would be in MA. That's already put into this forecast. It's already calculated. It does lead to the administrative question that you will see in here, another initiative that talks about communications, legal communications, and fair notice to everyone in current programs that we will do early, massively, and often so that there is no confusion. No matter what passes this legislature, that people understand where they sit in the eligibility for coverage, because they are legally obliged to receive that notice. And we will do it even more often than is legally necessary to diminish the confusion. But that's a massive group of people as well moving into MA coverage that would be currently enrolled in Minnesota Care. There are other examples, and that's a good question, and you'll get those answers.
Commissioner, keep drawing more interest all the time. So, just a comment for my view of this. I see this, you know, it's a proposal, and I think part of the nice thing about this coming so early on in the process is that we have the fiscal note process is a good debate process that's done during session, and oops, we forgot that group, and these are closer to real numbers now than what we even knew at the end of session about who might be eligible, who's going to ramp up. Didn't know they were coming in, didn't know they were left out. And so this gives us a good opportunity to look at these, a whole inch or two of fiscal notes of what we might do. And I would think that some of those will be picked and some will not be picked by the leadership. Representative Thiessen has another question.
Just one more kind of quick clarification on what Representative Broad was talking about. So the November forecast is based on basically kind of your best information from July or August. And so the February forecast numbers will be based kind of, is there a similar time lag as well?
Yes.
So we want
probably a look of August or September.
And so just, Mr. Chair, so does that take into account kind of then, I mean, but do you account for the kind of downturn in the economy since then as well? So that's factored into that. So we're not talking a time lag in that sense?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, good question. I think the February forecast will be delivered in the first week of March. And that is actually purposeful to be able to use February data, even in DHS forecasting for increased cost probably, but we don't anticipate it to be terribly significantly more from the November forecast, which took the biggest hit.
You're just talking to people are so interested. Do they just keep? No, there's more. There's two more people that want to talk to you, Commissioner. And maybe these will be the last two, not to rush anybody, but we have a whole book to go through, which has a few more questions. And Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for granting me a question. I really appreciate that, especially coming late. And I just want to say, Commissioner Lindeman, I just kind of am trying to boil down a little bit of what Representative Bradless and Stephen are talking about in terms of the projections. Have we looked at anything around people's inability to afford health care and making choices in terms of their employment in order to qualify? And let me just tell you where I'm going. I hear a lot of people talk about the cost of child care, and so sometimes people make choices maybe not to work because the child care exceeds what they can make. So has there been any kind of just talk anecdotally, or have you thought about, you know, potentially that becoming an issue if we disenroll that many people who can't afford health care in the private market?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a very good question. You're spilling a little over into an area of what we call our MFIT program, where many child care subsidy exists, but is also integrated with cash support, child care services, work participation, or searching for the next employment opportunity lie. But there's a health care component to that as well. But that is, I think your question is a little broader than just current MFIT participation. It's for the next unemployed person, perhaps, in Minnesota, which the stimulus package may or may not deal with as far as it relates to health care. But the choice level of what people are making as relative to what, is it more important for me to get child care and stay employed or keep health care or go into some other health care program, is a very complicated and personal choice environment that is hard to calculate. But believe me, we work very hard at our agency to make sure that our children and families division, which you will be represented by Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner, which you'll get to someday if I stop answering questions. I'm sorry. And then Brian Osberg, who is Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare, you will hear them talk in language that incorporates this integrated approach on how we view our clients, whether they be healthcare enrollees or MFIT participants as well.
Representative Angel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, as expected, you can see that most of our questions on both sides have to do with health, medical assistance, and the various health-related programs. But I just wanted you to know that I'm going to be very interested in efficiencies involved in the delivery of social services with our 87 county boards of commissioners. And specifically, I'm interested in how engaged county agencies have been in the development of your budget proposals in the areas of child protection. I'm interested in what caseloads look like today versus 10 years ago. And I'm really interested in the continuum of services that are available to, in fact, protect vulnerable children. And lastly, I want to underscore that we're all talking to counties, county agencies, who deliver many of these programs on behalf of the state and the legislature and the department. And the story is pretty bleak, pretty difficult to listen to county agencies. And I just pick out child protection as one of the programs. So you and your staff and will have to engage in this through the process.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative, that's a very good question. I actually am glad that other people are talking about other issues relative to it. Minnesota's in our child protection history for the last 10 or 12 years is a powerful, strong story. However, as you are recognizing, that we have asked our county social service agencies to do a ton of stuff, to do it differently without modern enough systems to be able to support it, although it's been improving greatly. Child support, for example, this is not a public program, but you use non-custodial support monies to do it in a more integrated way, has been very, very successful. Chuck Johnson will be the one that will tell you about this success. But I think if you recall, I made some reference to what the governor also made some call in the change in the infrastructure of human service delivery about an idea that having 84 human service entities or authorities within an 87-county state is unusual, but historical. We understand that history. We understand its value. But our communication level, and we have basically a state-directed human service delivery model, but county-administered. So most of the engagement or the door that most people walk through is at a county courthouse or a county human service building in 84, or actually all 87 counties have these doors that people enter into. It's our job administratively to make sure that those financial workers, child protection agencies, most of them spend most of their time in child and adult protection services, which are high-end, intimate relationships that they have to be delivered to be able to make a determination that this child or adult needs protection and needs it today and tonight. And it is our desire that every child is safe and warm tonight and in the right place with the best environment possible. I'm very encouraged for you to hear and anxious for you to hear about this North Star Child Care for Children, which is an integrated, simplifying, a single benefit set for all children in the child welfare system so that they can get the same kind and better treatment, whether they be in foster care, relative custody assistance, or adoptive assistance. We're very pleased at that proposal as an initiative.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Commissioner,
so much time
for your few moments of discussion.
Thank you very much, members of the committee.
Jane Rankin is next, and she's going to teach us how to get through the budget pages, I think.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jane Rankin. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And what I wanted to do is take a few minutes just to orient you to the materials in your budget book. As you perhaps picked up on the discussion between Commissioner Ludeman and some of your members, the governor's budget document is a change budget. In other words, it's a kind of a base plus or minus presentation. It is not a zero base budget. So in your document, the way it's oriented, the first 146 pages in the Department of Human Services is information about each proposed change that the governor is recommending in the Department of Human Services, change to the base funding level. What I would like to do quickly, I think it would be the easiest if you looked at an example. If you turn to page 59, this is the first change item in the continuing care section, and this is what Assistant Commissioner Coleman will take you through the detail on. But this is all change item pages are laid out the same. There's a summary of the fiscal impact at the top of the page, and then there's a quick summary of the recommendation, background information so you get oriented to where the proposal's coming from. There's a section usually with a highlighted head note called proposal that will give you the details of the proposal. And then there is also typically a section about relationship to base budget, although that may or may not be on the page depending on the particular item. There's also a reference to key goals and measures. Typically for the Department of Human Services, this is really connecting you back to our base budget documents, where there's a much more extensive discussion of our goals, missions, and performance measurements that we're doing. Then there's also sometimes a section on alternatives that were considered by the agency in developing the change item that you see that the governor's recommending. And there's typically a flag at the very bottom indicating if there will be statutory change related to the page. That will, you will see when the bills start being developed and you start to see bill language coming through. If there is a provision in a bill that relates to something in this governor's budget document, it will typically have an amendment to the statutory section that's flagged on the page for you. So you'll be able to make the connection at that point in your process. What I want to do now is orient you, ask you to look a little further back in your documents. If you go to page 263, what I'm pointing out here is the associated base budget information that ties to at least part of the change page that I just walked through for you. So starting on page 263, we are into the base budget section for the continuing care grant. And all of these base budget sections, they have been published and posted on the MMB website since early December, but they are included here in your document because without it, you don't have a good sense of where the change items fit, because you need to see what the base budget is that it's recommending a change to. So I wanted to quickly orient you to the fiscal pages, if you turn to page 264 or 265, just so you know that in every major area of the agency's budget, you will have you will see these kind of program summary documents, and it will tell you, in this case, on the left-hand side on page 264, it lays out for you the direct appropriations that fund activities in this area of the department's work. And one of the things you'll notice here is that it starts at the top with the direct general fund current appropriation. That would be considered the base. And then in the middle of the section, there's a small headnote that says governor's recommendations. And these are all titles of change items that you will see, you will have presented to you as this agency walks you through our governor's budget recommendations. And you can see line by line the dollar amount from a particular change item that applies to this program area of the agency. It does it fund by fund, so it starts out with general fund, and you see in this instance that's where the bulk of the change items are. It also lists the other funds that pay for some of the activities of this program. Then that's just the appropriations side of the appropriations view of the budget. There's also information for you presented from the expenditure side. And as you probably know, expenditures do not necessarily equal appropriations. There can be other resources that this agency gets other than what is directly appropriated in the budget bills that you will be putting together in a few months. But you've got three different slices of our expenditures. You have it, first of all, by fund, so it ties perhaps most directly to the appropriation side. And for example, if you notice on expenditures by fund under direct appropriations for general fund, you can see the first line shows the governor's recommendation of for the biennium $3 billion, because these are in thousands, $3,764,431. And if you compare to the appropriations table on the other side of the page, at the bottom of the general fund section, you see that same number. So in this case, there is a direct tie between the appropriations number in the governor's recommendation and our expenditures by appropriation. There are then, following on the page, the two other slices of our expenditures. One is called by category, and this has to do with the fiscal analyst might talk to you about object expense budgeting and expense budget codes. Typically, the vast majority of DHS expenditures goes out in a category called payments to individuals. That's because a lot of what our programs do is deliver grants to individuals. So that's why you see that's a very large number on this page. There's also other operating expenses. That would be a category that you would consider to be agency administration. Then the last section of this program summary page takes you through expenditures by activity. And this is just within, again, you're in the continuing care program of the agency, and so it's sorting out for you out of the funding that is summarized on this, on these two pages, which activities within the continuing care administration is being funded. And this is just one program. These two pages is the fiscal detail for one program at the agency. As you go through the budget document, there are comparable pages for every single program in the agency, and there's also, in some cases, it gets down to a next lower level called the budget activity. All of this information is to orient you to the base budget of the agency. There's also, to just finish quickly walking through the book, every once in a while you'll see some yellow pages highlighted. There's some that starts after page 269, and this is more specific detail for your information by funding source of what kinds of grants our agency is distributing. Much of this detail is really where you see the nitty-gritty of how the program gets delivered in the state. And so there's information there. Then at the very end of the document, there's a set of green-colored pages. This is supplemental material. It's to give you even more contextual information. It has some agency-wide budget charts, including, for example, there's some information about the agency's base FTEs. And I would say at this point that later on in the presentation on a different day, I think it's Thursday, there is a change page about the governor's recommended administrative reduction to the agency, and at that point I'll have a discussion of a little bit more about FTEs at the agency, so we can wait until that day to talk about that if that's all right. That is very quickly an orientation to the budget book. As I turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Coleman, his focus is going to be on those change pages at the beginning. But the information that he gives you is also then supported and made more complete by the other base budget information. And then, Mr. Chair, very quickly, Representative Cheeson is not in the room, but I wanted to say that I took note of his question about inflation, and my understanding is I think the statute is fairly limited in the area of the agency budget that it's referring to, but I have only been on the job 2 months, and I would like to beg the committee's indulgence to allow me to go back and look up that statute and understand exactly what the connection is to the budget document and then get back to you. Representative Thiessen, I was just talking about your question about inflation. Okay.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, what I will do is...
You can
it looks like this is related to the COLA specifically, so I will go back and look at what our base budget information was on that and get an answer to your question.
Thank you, Ms. Rankin. Any questions? I don't see any, so we'll start with Commissioner Coleman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good to be back with you again. The Continuing Care or Long-Term Care Administration, like all of DHS was asked to develop proposals for consideration that would reduce hundreds of millions of dollars from programs serving people who are elderly and people with disabilities. All of these programs and services that Minnesota at one time deemed important to fund. This committee and the legislature now faces that same question, where to make reductions and where to preserve services. I've recently been asked more than once what the effect would be if the continuing care budgets were reduced 10% or 15%. The answer is, in our judgment, it depends on how you do it. If you only reduce rates to providers, the rate reductions necessary would be so large that a great number of them would go out of business, and people would lose access to services. If you only limit access to benefits, for example, by freezing long-term the access to waivers, some people would continue to receive a benefit package because they were able to receive a slot when the slots were available, while others who may need those services may be unable to get them. I believe that if reductions are going to be made, a balanced approach is needed, one that looks at access to services, access to benefit sets, and rates, as well as searching for any efficiencies and simplifications that will help more people get the services that they need. Adding to this challenge is the rapid growth projected for many of these programs. You all know about the demographic realities of the aging baby boom generation. The demand on our elderly service programs will at least double in the next 25 years. And Minnesotans with disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and physical disabilities also is growing, in part because people with disabilities are living longer. People who might have died from injuries a decade ago survive today but need assistance as they move forward with their lives. In preparing this budget, we challenged ourselves to develop policy changes that made sense in terms of managing these programs into the future. So in developing these proposals, we asked ourselves, how can we ensure that these valuable programs will be sustainable over the long term? Today's status quo won't work for tomorrow's challenges. That's why this package includes changes that focus nursing facility care and some community-based services to people with higher needs, while directing those who are more independent to federal and state grants that offer more limited benefits. The package provides needed reforms to the personal care attendant program to simplify assessment processes, assure quality of services and program integrity, and to manage the overall growth. This package of proposals limits growth in the most extensive benefit sets. For example, there is a proposal to limit use of corporate shift staff foster care, which is the single most expensive benefit set in the waiver programs, costing on average $80 to $100 more than comparable family foster care models. This package caps medical assistance payments for the most expensive assisted living services, called 24-hour customized living, for the top 5% of all such settings. And this package puts limits on the overall growth of the disability waiver programs while allowing modest growth. We look for ways to simplify programs. For example, our PCA reform proposal simplifies the assessment process and method for authorizing hours of service. And our nursing facilities single bed proposal reduces paperwork for nursing facilities while making single beds available to more medical assistance recipients. Finally, we do desire to preserve access to needed services by making changes in access to long-term care services, changes in benefits, and changes in rates by making changes across a broad array of long-term care programs and services. The intent is to lessen the overall impact on any one sector. I won't claim that this package of proposals doesn't have impact upon people, consumers, providers, long-term care workers. No solution will be ideal in dealing with the deficit as large as we have. But that has been our approach. And if you'd like, I will begin walking through the pages and presenting the proposals beginning on page 59.
Why don't you start walking through the pages then, Commissioner?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the first proposal on page 59 addressing raising the threshold for nursing facility level of care criteria, which determines access to not only nursing facilities but home and community-based service waivers and the state-funded alternative care program also. One of the greatest pressures on the growth of public long-term care spending in both nursing facilities and home and community-based services is the increase in the population, particularly for those over 65 years of age, as I mentioned, the baby boomers that will begin needing services. The number of people who will be eligible for Minnesota's long-term care programs is projected to increase to unsustainable levels. Therefore, the proposal has three components that I'll review. Raising the threshold for nursing facility level of care. We've prepared a document. It should be in your book. Hopefully it's lavender, so you can find it easily towards the back of the book, I would suspect. Be helpful if you find that to orient yourself to the proposal.
It was the page was passed out today, so it's this one here. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Gregan.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As indicated, the nursing facility level of care criteria determines the threshold for those on medical assistance who seek access to nursing facilities and the EW, CADI, and CBI services, as well as alternative care. What we are proposing is that individuals would have to have a high need in activities of daily living, at least four of those, and I'm right in the middle of the boxes here, or a high need for ADLs that require 24-hour staff availability. There are certain ADLs which are not predictive. You can't dictate when somebody is going to need assistance. So it's a combination of those ADLs. Or an individual may need a clinical monitoring at least once a day, or a significant cognitive impairment or behavioral need, or are at risk of an institutional stay. Those are the criteria. Now, the question has been asked, what's our current criteria? And quite frankly, it's not really well defined. And so we are trying to define it more explicitly as to who are these programs intended to serve and target it to those individuals with higher needs. The second part of the proposal for the nursing facility level of care is to acknowledge that there will be individuals now and into the future who have low needs but yet real needs and would not qualify based upon this current or proposed definition of level of care. And so on page 60, we are recommending a modest investment per individual to help people remain independent. Some examples are listed on the page. Sometimes something as simple as a lifeline, subscribing to that service is enough to provide safety for an individual to live independently. Caregiver support and education, we know that supporting caregivers is of great interest, respite care and things of that nature, and education, homemaker services, chore services. This list is not meant to be limiting. It's meant to display examples of some low-cost services that can help people who would not qualify under the new criteria. It would be administered through the counties. We would distribute money to the counties and then work with the counties to provide this modest support to individuals. We think it's a significant signal to all of us that we need to plan better. We need to look for low-cost alternatives to the nursing facilities and the waivers as they are currently defined. The third,
Commissioner, the services that you're going to provide for these people outside of the nursing home, if they don't go into the nursing home, is there a federal match with that?
Mr. Chair, the this component would, I don't believe, get a federal match. The essential community services would be grant funding only.
Thank you.
Representative
Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, in order to, you know, really make informed decisions on all of these pages as we go here, whether it's defined target population or whatever means, I'm going to need to know how many less Minnesotans will be eligible for and receive a service that was previously available to them in the current biennial budget setup.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anzo, if you look under bullet 2 on page 60, we've tried to anticipate that question, and we've indicated that we believe about 1,100 people currently who are receiving elderly waiver, alternative care, would no longer qualify for those services under this proposal. The way we define the proposal, no one currently living in a nursing facility would be required to move.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative, just to follow up on that, Mr. Chair, because I appreciate that 1,100 number, but I've heard also a number of 4,300, and is there a difference between long-term care eligibility and MA versus some other type of long-term care? Can you tell me where the 4,300 number comes from as opposed to the 1,100 number?
Okay, I gotta get my computer working here.
Maybe there's someone else.
We'll get the numbers. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the 4,300 are those that would not be eligible under this criteria, but they are eligible for other state plan services, so they don't lose coverage. The 1,100 are those who would not be eligible under level of care or state plan services. So the 1,100 are the lowest need and would not have any eligibility, and that's what we're trying to address with this part of the proposal.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The other state plan services, then, what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Houston, it would be home care, things of that nature that still allow them to receive services, basic health care, et cetera.
Thank you.
Representative Abler, last question.
Isn't that? That's pretty good. Well, this is maybe a helpful question to end up with. This is the first page of a whole book, and now we're getting not even to the first page. We're going to be called on to make some difficult choices, and when we step through this, in my 2003, I talked about essential, important, and nice, and how we have to find ways to get the people need our services the most, and there's not any time for specific questions, but it seems to me this is a scalable kind of proposal. We could allow 3 ADLs, we allow 5, and presume the department has numbers on those kinds of savings, but I, at some point, whatever money comes from President Obama, and whatever money we generate from any source, we're going to have to not do some things we do now. And I think this is an intriguing idea as we consider finding people with the greatest needs and attempt to serve them. And that's, I had questions, but I'm stopping. So thanks.
Well, we're right out of time here, Commissioner Coleman, and I will have to announce to the members and the public that we're going to schedule a meeting on Thursday evening at 6:15, because otherwise I don't think we'll get done this week. So I thank you for being here. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will adjourn the meeting.